Thanks to everyone for coming out tonight on this sweltering day to Tuesday Night Live, a talk about two incredible cultural institutions, Saturday Night Live and The New Yorker. Before we start, I want to thank Working Loose, which is both a gallery and a store, as you can see, and do come back when there aren't a million chairs set up in here. And we want to thank Matt Murphy from WERU for doing our sound, and Blue Hill Community Development, our fiscal sponsor. And I want to just invite everybody to come out to the Flash Dance on Monday night, because it will be a benefit for Word and help us continue to do events like this one. And of course, our big festival in the fall, in between Indigenous Peoples Day and Halloween. Just remember that. Okay, our guests tonight are Susan Morrison and Daniel Zaleski. Susan is the author of Lorne, The Man Who Invented Saturday Night Live, and she's the articles editor at The New Yorker. Previously, she was the editor-in-chief of The New York Observer, and she was an original editor at Spy, which is one of those if you know, you know credentials that impresses the ones who know. Dan is the executive editor, Daniel is the executive editor at The New Yorker, and he was previously an editor at The New York Times Magazine and at Lingua Franca, even more of a if you know, you know credential. And because they are both editors as well as writers, and their work isn't always that visible, I just want to mention the names of some of the writers they edit, so that you know that if you've read and enjoyed their work, probably Susan and Daniel had a hand in it. Susan has edited Larry David, Steve Martin, Ian Fraser, and Patricia Marks, all people who are incredibly funny, which is obviously an area of expertise. And Daniel has edited Jane Mayer, Lawrence Wright, David Gran, and Patrick Redden Keefe. So that's a pretty stellar list of writers who owe at least something to their talents. Welcome them to Blue Hill, and I'm going to give you that back.
Thank you, Laura. I know that sometimes people perceive New Yorker editors to be dolers out of commas and things like that, you know, that we're sort of a fortress of propriety. But I've always thought of Susan as the fun one at our office. Not only does she edit the Shouts and Murmurs, the humor section, but as you'll see, she has now written the definitive book on one of the comedy institutions of our age. And as somebody who worshipped Spy as a suburban rube and wondered how on earth it had come together, I'm so thrilled for this book and this success for her. And we're going to start off by letting Susan just read the first page of her book, which kind of sets up sort of the tone and structure.
Thank you, Daniel. We'll get into Daniel's genius a little bit later, but here we go. Every week at Saturday Night Live is just like every other week. Every week is the same because it's always intense, fueled by insanely hard work, full of triumphs and failures and backstage explosions, and because it's built around a guest host, Jennifer Lopez or Lizzo or Elon Musk, who often has no idea what they are doing. It has been Lorne Michaels' job for the last 50 years to make it seem as if they do, and to corral the egos and the talents on his staff into getting the show on the air live. Since he created the show in 1975, he's periodically tweaked and fine-tuned it, paying attention to how the cultural winds are drifting. But the formula has essentially remained the same. Michaels compares it to a Snickers bar. Viewers expect a certain amount of peanuts, a certain amount of caramel, a certain amount of chocolate. There's a comfort level, he says. The show has good years and bad years, like the New York Yankees or the Dow, and the audience has come to feel something like ownership of it. Just about every person who has ever watched SNL believes that its funniest years were the ones when they were in high school. Michaels likes to say that everyone in the entertainment business has two jobs, their actual job and figuring out how to fix SNL. When J.D. Salinger died in 2010, letters surfaced in which even he griped about what was wrong with the show. The show's cast members and writers have speculated for years about the secret behind Michael's extraordinary tenure. It's him and Hitchcock, John Mulaney says. No one else has had this kind of longevity. Half of them believe that Michaels has repeatedly been able to remake the show for a new audience because he's a once-in-a-lifetime talent, a producer nonpareil. The other half wonders whether Michaels' gnomic and almost comically elusive is a blank screen onto which they've all projected a lifetime of hopes and fears and dark jokes, and whether he, like the cramped stages in SNL's Studio 8H, is just a backdrop for the ever-shifting brilliance of the country's best comic minds. Thank you.
I'm glad you read that, because I think it's something that we should all kind of marvel at. You know, that show is in its 50th year. And it wasn't too long ago that I watched the very first episode of the program. And in some ways, it was like teleporting back in time to, you know, a different era and sensibility where there'd be certain jokes that you wouldn't do. But it was astonishing how durable the formula was. And I think there is something about when someone creates something with a kind of masterstroke of structure that can not just last a season or two and be a viral sensation, but can endure over the years.
Yeah. Yes, it's definitely, the formula is definitely durable like a Snickers bar. But one of the things that's interesting about it is that when Lorne was pitching this show around Hollywood in the early 70s, one of the things he told executives is that he called it new wine in old bottles. And what he meant by that is he liked the old variety show format, you know, as the Sid Caesar, Kraft Comedy Hour, you know, even a lot of the crappy variety shows that he got writing jobs on as a very young man, like the beautiful Phyllis Diller show, Perry Como's Christmas Spectaculars. But what was, you know, but the format, you know, jokes, music, sometimes animal acts, which he hasn't had in SNL. He thought that format, you know, which is as old as vaudeville, was worth saving. What he wanted to do that was a radical idea in 1975 was to put his generation's concerns on the air, to change the subject matter. You know, one of his earliest collaborators was Lily Tomlin. And when they met in the 70s, one of the things they bonded over was how it really bugged them if you were watching a Bob Hope special when you know, the writers had decided, you know, in a naughty way to have a sketch about marijuana, but the actors who, instead of, you know, when they were trying to play stoned, they just acted drunk because they didn't know the difference, you know. So Lorne and Lily wanted to put sex, drugs, and rock and roll on the air, and that's what they did.
Yeah, and they also kind of put, you know, a kind of political directness. I mean, George Carlin was the first host, and there was a real, you know, just kind of overt, you know, sort of bite to what he was saying that was sort of unusual for network television at the time. And some of the things that you realize, you know, they seem familiar to us, but were kind of almost revolutionary at the time, was like parodies of commercials and a kind of mockery of entertainment as a kind of business that was trying to, you know, glaze your mind with kind of cliches and kind of, you know, advertiser-friendly material. And so, you know, the show kind of pioneered a kind of mockery of that kind of material.
No, that's right. Lorne always, you know, he felt that by the time he got to Hollywood, it had become so insincere. Like, it really bothered him that somebody would come out on stage and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to my very best friend," you know, about someone that a William Morris agent had introduced him to 5 minutes ago in the wings. You know, it was just all of this very glossy, slick stuff. And again, what Lorne wanted to do is when he hired his actors, he didn't want slick show business professionals. You know, he thought comedy was too important to be left to the professionals. He wanted people, you know, like like everyone's funny friends, sort of mischievous, a little bit fed up, and willing to just yap about it.
Yeah, and I think one thing that people wonder about him, I mean, you may have seen Austin Powers, in which Dr. Evil is reportedly a parody of Lorne Michaels, and that's always like a form of revenge in which comedians kind of get back at the person who part of his job was to say no to their jokes and to sometimes say we're not going to put that skit on the air. But I think that one thing that people often wonder about him is, as somebody who has been the kind of comedy judge, in such a kind of prominent way, is he funny? Is he, I remember in the book, there's a quote in which, I can't remember which, was it Jane Curtin who said, Lorne Michaels never laughs at a joke. The most you're gonna get is a kind of rictus smile that, what you're getting is the absence of a frown, in a way. And that's because, that job is so stressful. It's happening in 1 week, and you have to be ruthless. And almost in the final hours before the program, this is one of the great things when you read the book, is you see what an absolutely hurtling, relentless train they're on. And where Lorne Michaels, to me, seems the most brilliant is he's almost like an ER doctor of humor, where he's like, this, no, step, cut this. And it is, it's no laughing matter,
Yeah, there is this thing in the comedy industry, people call it a kind of, like a Hillcrest country club. That's, where sort of all the old Jewish comics played golf in Beverly Hills. This thing of just like staying with a perfectly straight face, that's hilarious. And Lorne has a reputation, that's what Jane Curtin was referring to,
yeah.
But I think over the years, as he's grown into himself and loosened up, that he actually is a very funny person, and he not only laughs uproariously, which is not all the time, but it's what these people live for, to actually make Lorne put his head down on the table laughing helplessly. But he is incredibly funny. Bob Odenkirk, among others, told me how unusual it is on a comedy show to have your boss be someone who actually was a comedy writer. And Lorne was a working comedy writer for 10 years, because these days, it's like college deans, like they're bureaucrats. Most executives just come out of Harvard Business School or something. They have not written jokes for, Joan Rivers and Lily Tomlin. But,
Yeah, and actually, in the book, because this the book begins, right in his, it begins with an evocation of, was it Sunday or Monday?
It's Monday.
Yeah, it's Monday. And in a great way, the book tacks between a thoroughly reported, deeply insiderish, and deeply naughty account of 1 week of Saturday Night Live from, 2015 or 16?
2018.
And it... What was brilliant about this, because we as magazine editors often are trying to get people into exclusive environments, and powerful people don't want you in their conference room. They're often worried, I'd like to read that piece, but I don't want the people at Paramount to know that, my colleague thinks I'm an idiot, or, made this undercutting remark, or that, on an impulse in some meeting, I made the wrong call, and 3 months later, it was obvious that I canceled the show that everyone thought was great. And so Susan's brilliant sort of, gambit was to say, let me see everything, but I'm not and write whatever I want, but I'm not going to publish it until almost everybody in that particular season isn't on the show right now, except for Lorne. And
well, I have to say, none of us knew it was going to take this long. I worked on this.
I'm giving you credit.
I worked on this book for 10 years, which we didn't really expect. And I mean, let me also say right here that I've been an editor for 4 decades, and this is not just my first book. It's my first published piece of writing, and it blows my mind that my first published piece of writing basically hit the stores the same month I applied for Medicare. So that's an inspirational story, people. Just to speak to what Daniel was saying, I plunged into the research for this book, and I realized, again, never having done anything like this and never not realizing how encyclopedic it was going to have to be, I suddenly realized, oh, if I just tell his life story chronologically. And usually, as editors, we tell our writers, chronology is your friend. You know, it's generally a safe structure. But I realized if you've got 80 years of somebody's life and you're just going to unfurl them, that you risked, you know, I risked having it be like a death march through the years. And especially with something like SNL, which is broken into annual seasons, I thought, oh God, you know, it's going to be like then 1997 turned into 1998. And so this is where my background as a magazine editor helped me, because in all the pieces that I edit, I'm always trying to get my writers to put scenes in their pieces, meaning not just, you know, I don't want an overview of an event or an overview of a personality. I want you to be in the room with the people, like what Daniel was saying, at a meeting, in their house, you know, walking on the beach with them. So you can sort of see what they look like and sound like and see how they interact with other people. So when I asked Lauren to let me, if I could just embed at the show for a week, I knew that that was going to give me that kind of, you know, material that I could write so that it almost, each day, almost is like a little short film. Yeah. You know, you hear everybody talk and you see Lauren perform his own personal psycho jujitsu on everybody. And it also, to go back to the previous topic, it allowed me to see Lorne in real time being funny in a way that other people never get to see him be. And one thing that I remember, to me, this really cracked me up. I mean, we would commiserate sometimes about millennials in the workplace. I hope I'm not offending anybody in the room. But anyway, he was telling me one day that his friend Margaret Trudeau was in town and wanted to see the musical Mean Girls, which he produced. And so he got her tickets. But at the last minute, the lead actress in the show called in sick, and the understudy was going to have to go on. And he said, well, where is she? And she had to take her dog to the vet because the dog had eaten glue. And Lauren was very unhappy about that. And he said, if it was Patti LuPone's dog, it would be dead. Which I thought was a very funny remark.
Anyway. Yeah, and there's actually, you know, when I said naughty, part of the fun of reading this, tell people, like, who was the guest star, and yeah.
So yeah, the host that week was Jonah Hill. And one of the real, so the way I used these chapters is I threaded them through the book, so it's kind of like a braided narrative. You begin Monday, and this kind of, you know, the pressure is not so bad on Monday. The host is meeting the writers and the cast and everyone. It's just a big love fest. The idea is to make the host feel supported and happy. And then, you know, so then chapter two is snowy Toronto in the 1940s, where, you know, Lauren is watching Sid Caesar on TV. And it kind of cuts through, culminates in the emergency room atmosphere of Saturday night. And so it gives the book this kind of propulsive force, because one thing, I mean, I knew this intellectually, but until I was actually in these rooms seeing this stuff happen, I didn't realize that, you know, by Wednesday in that place, it's like Game of Thrones, you know. I mean, the tension just ratchets up day by day as things kind of fall off the schedule. And it goes up till, you know, it isn't until 10:30 on Saturday that people know if they're even going to be on the air. You know, Seth Meyers told me the worst thing that can happen to you at that show is to not even need hair and makeup on Saturday. You know, you've worked all week on your thing and rehearsed it and costumes and sets and everything, and then at 11 it might just be yanked off the board and all those, you know, $10,000 worth of sets are in the dumpster by morning. And so, but seeing that level of tension ramping up was just such a great narrative device.
Yeah, and there's really a sense, yeah, spoiler alert, Leslie Jones was not happy that week, you know, and there was a sense that, you know, she was, you know, and it's both funny and kind of a serious thing when you feel like there's a comedian who feels that, you know, things aren't going her way, that the writers necessarily aren't giving her the best material, but she almost has like these very few moments to kind of blurt out, like, you know, I want to do this, or, you know, this isn't, you know, once again, it's going to this other person. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the breakfast scene in Oliver or something, where everyone's everyone's just trying to like, you know, get right. their bowl all at once. And so you can feel the emotion because there's no time to hide it. And I think that's one thing that you see. And then with Jonah Hill, there is, you know, a kind of vanity of the celebrity guest where, you know, they want to be wacky, but they also want to be handsome. They want to, you know,
they want all the jokes. You know, they want to be the funny person in every sketch. And the writers, you know, confided in me that, you know, their favorite kind of host is actually someone who's like a really fine actor, someone like Adam Driver, who is happy to do what they call support parts, you know, in sketches, and just will be part of the ensemble. And the worst thing is when the host just wants to be the funny one in every sketch. I mean, Amy Poehler had a great story. She told me about one of her first shows. She wrote a sketch that she was the star of. It did really well at the read-through. They read all the sketches out loud, 40 of them, on Wednesday. And the host liked it, but the host said, well, I want to play that part. I want the lead. And Amy said she went back to her office and she thought, okay, is this some kind of a test? How should I play this? If I stand up for myself and say, no, it's my sketch, the sketch will probably get tanked. It won't even get on the air. You know, what should I do? And so what she did is she rewrote it and she gave the host the plum part, but she wrote a big funny part for herself in it as well. So it's this kind of, you see people learning this kind of stuff. And this is why writers at no other TV shows give writers kind of that much power to create and direct and produce and attend to all the details of their sketches. And this is why people like Amy Poehler and Tina Fey and Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, you know, the show produces so many showrunners and directors and producers because they learn all these lessons, you know, about how to keep everybody happy. And I wonder, this might be a good place, Daniel, to transition into something that we've talked a lot about, which is another thing that was fun for me as I, you know, spent all these years talking to Lorne about this stuff. And I think it explains some of the good groove that he and I got into talking about millennials and otherwise, is that there's a lot of similarities between his job and the job that Daniel and I do. You know, we all of us are kind of dealing with an unruly group of creative egos who all want, you know, they don't, at SNL they want airtime, in the New Yorker they want pages.
18,000 words.
You know, yeah, they want a lot of words. Yeah. Our job, we have to say no to them again and again and again, and yet keep them enthused and motivated. I mean, what are some other similarities?
Yeah, well, I was thinking the other day, I actually heard Amy Poehler on her podcast the other day. She was talking about, on Saturday Night Live, she described it as the athleticism that you needed to develop as a generator of ideas, because you so often had to trash an idea. And what she said is that, you know, the worst thing as a creator, at least in her view, of comedy, was to believe that the last thing you'd written was the best thing you'd ever done, and that if it didn't happen, the world would end. Because what the discipline of Lorne often saying, no, we're not going to do that, or we're going to, you know, delay that for 3 weeks, is that she developed the confidence to know, well, if that doesn't happen, I'm going to have another good idea tomorrow. And like, that's a discipline. And I feel like that's actually, you know, I run the weekly ideas meeting at the New Yorker, Tuesday at 4, so it's kind of like Tuesday at the New Yorker. And, you know,
missed it today.
Yeah. I often tell people, you know, 80% of ideas I think are really strong never quite make it into the magazine for various reasons. You know, sometimes because a writer will like fondle it like a cat for a year and then decide no, or because, you know, another writer will say, you know, I'm thinking about it, but then the Atlantic will do the exact story that we wanted to do. And so the level of attrition that I and you deal with as editors, you know, we just have to say it. That was a good idea, but it's over now. And then you move on to the very next thing. And in some ways, because the New Yorker has this reputation as being this kind of stately, timeless object, you know, because you kind of can read it at any time, people almost forget that it is also a weekly manic rush to the finish line every single week. And I think that is one of the reasons why Lorne felt understood by you, is that you guys, in some ways, occupy, you know, especially as the editor of Shouts and Murmurs and somebody who has to be able to understand comedians enough so that the no is respected. And that's one thing that is clear, is that even though his no's hurt, his no's are not disrespected.
You know? Yes, yeah, I think the idea of keeping people motivated while saying no to them is the tough thing that we all have to do. And, you know, I say, I mean, I also edit the Talk of the Town section, the short pieces at the front, and a lot of young, new people on the staff write those. It's their entryway into writing for the magazine. But there are people, you know, young newbies at the magazine who turn them in with this expectation of like, okay, let's put this in the magazine. And some, you know, sometimes they're just not really good enough on the first try. And I'll have to say, you know, well, Mark Singer and Sandy Frazier, you know, they had a dozen talk pieces killed before one went in the magazine. And a lot of people don't realize that. You know, it's really hard to get it right on the first try. And there is, you know, that atmosphere at SNL too. It seems maybe more cutthroat than at the New Yorker because it's done live with no net. I mean, it really is like a live sporting event, as I think Amy was indicating. But Daniel, I know something people always like to know. I mean, I was saying that at SNL they write 40 sketches and they do a read through. Why don't you explain to people how our idea generating process works? I find that most people out there believe that, and I think this is the way it worked in the William Shawn era, that writers just come to us and say, I want to write about X. Yes. And that is not at all what happens.
Yes. Yeah, the famous story for that version of it was that, you know, somebody walked in the hall to Mr. Shawn, as he was only and ever called, and said, Coca-Cola. And he said, yes. And then, you know, a 40,000 word article about the Coca-Cola company was produced, you know, 27 months later, probably, given that timetable. But actually, when I arrived at the New Yorker, I had worked at the New York Times Magazine under an editor who ran a very different kind of publication. It was what I would call an editor-driven publication, meaning you would call a lot of freelancers at the Times Magazine, and you would say, we want you to do this. And Adam Moss, brilliant editor, but boy, did he want exactly what he'd come up with in that conference room. And he would be like fiercely disappointed if the writer had sort of gone his own way. David Remnick and, you know, the people who work with him, it's a writers-centered magazine. So even though we like to hear their ideas, we say yes to some of them, no to others, we also come up with ideas ourselves all the time. And we present them to them. But what we don't do is say, you're going to Atlanta and you're writing about the Coca-Cola company. What we have to do is we're almost like the desperate screenwriter at the Hollywood studio pitching them and trying to help them imagine an idea that we think is really well suited towards them. And the idea is never imposed. Like, and that's why there's a kind of willingness to let them be fickle, because when you spend 4 or 7 months writing an article, you have to love that experience, or the end result is going to convey your frustration, boredom, distaste, what have you, your snobbery, why am I doing this? And so you have to seduce a writer into feeling like, this is an idea that I love as much as if I had come up with it myself. And so it's an interesting kind of power relation for us where we both are like assigning things, but we're really like auditioning as much as we're assigning.
And one of the things that I think is, to me, the most interesting part of our jobs that people, I think, outside don't realize is explaining, sometimes someone will come to us with a topic, like they want to write about, the Great Barrier Reef or something, yeah. Just a topic, but that isn't an idea, you know, that isn't like an idea that has sort of a narrative structure, an approach, a point of view, and that's sort of what we do. We'll sort of sit down with them almost like a shrink and try to figure out what the angle of attack is going to be, what the act, you know, who's the protagonist going to be, how are you going to turn this into storytelling rather than just a topic, which is like maybe the way the New York Times would cover it.
Yes, I actually remember a discussion once where we were talking about the, you know, coral bleaching at the Great Barrier Reef, and the glorious moment of revelation is when somebody used the term coral sperm, which I was unaware of at the time, but which is, you know, part of the way that they reproduce. And then there was this, you know, there were these scientists who apparently were like kind of developing new ways to use coral sperm to create coral reefs in which you had taken like a coral reef from Indonesia, and you were in the manner of, you know, Neanderthals and humans sleeping together back in the Pleistocene, getting these two corals to kind of combine, creating a never before created coral, and thus saving the reef. And that's when you realize, okay, you know, there's a scientist, there's an adventure, there's maybe a writer who's gonna like put on some scuba gear and describe what it's like down there, and there's some kind of funny terminology that you're kind of happy to share at a cocktail party, and there's, you know, a chance there's some real like travel writing and contemplation about, you know, the fragility of nature. That's a story.
So you're really planning out a roadmap with the writer. You know, who are they gonna talk to? You don't want, I mean, I have a phrase I sometimes use to describe the kind of story that doesn't really work, which is that it's like a string of pearls. Like this person said that, this person said that, this person said that, but there's no kind of narrative build. Anyway, so that is what we do. And this just reminded me of another thing that I had wanted to mention when we were talking about the similarities between the magazine and the show. There is, you know, Lorne Michaels spent 50 years kind of avoiding talking to reporters. He always liked to be the man behind the curtain. He didn't ever like to be, you know, I mean, he didn't mind Dr. Evil, but he didn't like to talk to journalists. And so I knew him very slightly because I worked for him for a couple of months in the 1980s. And when I, 10 years ago, when I got this idea that I would write, after watching the 40th anniversary special, that I would like to write a book about him, I sold the book to Random House, and then I went to see him in his office. And you know, I'd seen him maybe once every 5 years since the 80s. But so I said, Lorne, I've just sold this book about you. I don't need anything from you. You know, I'm, you know, no people in your world, and you know, Steve Martin is one of my writers, and blah blah blah. But if you would like to talk to me, it would, you know, make the book kind of much richer and better. And he, you know, he looked like he was going to have a coronary because he he hates surprises. I mean, that is one of the things about producers. You know, they have to know what's going to happen all the time. And for, you know, I would have been able to write it without him, but he did come around. And one of the reasons I realized has to do with an old New Yorker connection. So in the very first year of the show, in 1975, like the fifth show, I think it was hosted by Richard Pryor, the great, amazing American comedian. And at that show, the New Yorker writer Lillian Ross, a kind of legendary profile writer at the New Yorker who profiled everybody from Hemingway to Charlie Chaplin to Truffaut, showed up with her companion, William Shawn. They were both comedy fanatics, and I mean, a lot of people don't know this about Sean. He loved Richard Pryor. He loved comedy.
His favorite movie late in life was This Is Spinal Tap.
That's right. I was about to say that. So they showed up, and they took Lorne under their wing. And, you know, he was Lorne Lipowitz, this furrier son from Toronto. He didn't know uptown from downtown. They showed him around. They you know, took him to La Caravelle, this great French restaurant, and told him what to order, introduced him to William Maxwell. And Lillian started this decades-long process of writing a big profile of him, which he found, you know, very exciting. Now, you might remember that William Shawn was suddenly fired in the mid-80s, when not long after Condé Nast acquired The New Yorker. So Lillian never finished that profile. She never wrote the profile. And so years later, when I showed up in Lorne's office, I mean, he knew that I was Lillian's editor, and we were great, great friends. He had seen the two of us together. I think something, you know, he was kind of superstitious, and I think a kind of a penny dropped in his head, and he felt that there was a sort of kismet in me picking up this thread that she had left dangling. And so there's just something very nice about this full circle moment involving the New Yorker. And then, of course, this year in February, we at the New Yorker celebrated the New Yorker's 100th anniversary. And it was exactly the same week that SNL celebrated its 25th anniversary. So these two big New York-based institutions, you know, kind of, I think, have a lot of peculiar overlap.
Yeah, and it's strange to think that Mr. Sean, who I never met, but like, you know, was sort of, you know, famous for his sort of formality and kind of social discomfort. And Lorne Michaels, that you kind of speak of them in the same breath. But I think there is a kind of obsession with figures like that, in part because they have written the rules of an institution. Like, you know, I've come to the New Yorker, I arrived in like 2003 or something like that, you know, but I inherited a bunch of rules and I found them fascinating, but the person who had created those rules is gonna be both a subject of obsession and the focus of all the rebellion, because it's almost like that person is God. And I kind of wonder, like, when you think of, you know, this book is full of passive aggressive commentary by brilliant comedians from like Bill Hader, you know, it just goes on and on. And you can tell they love Lorne Michaels in many ways and recognize that he kind of authorized the kind of scripts of modern comedy that they live by, but they also can't stand him in a certain way because they wrote the rule. He wrote the rules, and comedians in particular are rule breakers. You know, so what, like when you think of that part of your book, like, you know, what is a great story of sort of the rivalry between, you know, a sort of, you know, either a writer or a performer and Lorne?
Well, I mean, both Sean and Lorne are objects of obsession to their staffs, which keeps them on their toes and keeps them doing their best work. But so well, I mean, just here's just one little example of Lorne. I mean, this isn't a big, mighty example, but just all the writers and cast told me about little, you know, stories of you know, kind of bristling with him. And one of his, he's a person who has a lot of rules and axioms, Cohens, the people in his life call them. And one of them about comedy he uses all the time is, he says, do it in sunshine. And what he means by that is, you know, resist the urge to be kind of indie and underground and dark. He always wants the writers to remember that comedy is an entertainment, you know. And if you think about the posters for all the movies that he's produced, like Wayne's World and, you know, so many others, a lot of the posters, most of them, are the background is a blue sky with white fluffy clouds. Mm-hmm. But so to give you an example of this do it in sunshine thing, he, you know, he wants the people to look attractive. He just wants it to be bright and fun. And the writer Bruce McCulloch, who is a member of the Canadian comedy troupe, The Kids in the Hall, wrote on the show in the 90s. And once at dress rehearsal, Lorne's notes on one of Bruce's sketches, Joan Cusack was in it, and she was playing a teacher. And Lorne said, you know, why does she look so dowdy? She's a beautiful woman. Why do you have her looking like such a frump? And this just really irritated Bruce. And so he said, okay, Lorne, I'll put her in a fucking bikini. And, you know, Bruce then said, I can't believe I didn't get fired for that. Because, you know, in hindsight, there's a lot of people in this book who, when they're 23 and kind of, you know, newly famous and making money and everything, are, you know, pushing back against Lorne and really bratty and fighting with him about everything. And then 20 or 30 years later, almost like people in AA who are making amends, they send him these letters and say, I'm so sorry. I was such a dick when I worked for you. Now that I'm an adult and I know how hard it is to manage people, and you know, I see how complicated your job was. But you know, so it's this kind of thing over and over again. Him like tweaking things and changing things, and people pushing back. And you know, Bob Odenkirk, who wrote there in the 90s, was always saying, you know, why is this guy in charge? He's in his 50s.
Exactly. And how old is he now? He's
Lorne's 80.
Exactly. You know, and one thing that, you know, it is kind of amazing to think, you know, there's this 80-year-old who, you know, is deciding, Pete Davidson, you're the one, you know. And so I think a lot of people, you know, if you see the show, you know, you're kind of first page, ask that question, you know, is he a comedy savant? Or, you know, I know, you know, with our boss, David Remnick, you know, part of the gift of being, you know, the leader of an institution like that is there's certain things with absolutely unfailing instinct, he knows that he's the person with the right answer for this question. And you know, his judgment is right. And then there are times when he comes with like a funny cover and he just asks the young people in the office.
Which sometimes is a mistake.
Exactly. But, you know, there.
It is the right instinct, though. Yeah. And I think David and Lorne do have something, there is something similar in the way they approach their jobs. They both have bedrock, very excellent taste, you know, to the core. And both jobs are about taste, you know, which is very personal. At the same time, they both really care what the 24-year-olds think. You know, they listen to 24-year-olds. And it isn't just to kind of, you know, get that demographic. I mean, they're really, really curious. And I mean, all good journalists have to stay curious. Lillian Ross, who we were just talking about, died at 99. You know, she wanted to be the magazine's first 100-year-old Talk of the Town writer and missed it by 3 months. But she, you know, I remember her pitching a story on Lin-Manuel Miranda 10 years before Hamilton. You know, she knew, she cared what the young people were doing. And Lorne, you know, he's always been mindful. Look, when he started in TV, it was being written by, you know, he was a young hippie, and the people in the writer's room with him were these paunchy guys in their 50s who had written for radio. And so he always wanted, he was always mindful of not becoming like the old guy trying to impose his taste, like the phrase I often use, like he didn't want to be, you know, like a grandmother with a hula hoop. You know, he hires really good young people, and then he really listens to them. He really, really delegates. I've seen him in a meeting, you know, just kind of keeping a little tally of who speaks, you know, who says something, and he kind of won't end the meeting until everyone in the room has spoken. You know, he really wants to hear from everybody.
Yeah, and I think even at, you know, at the New Yorker, yeah, a lot of the people at the New Yorker are in their 50s or 60s. But, you know, there's no greater pleasure for me, you know, at that Tuesday meeting, which isn't the same group of editors. We invite photo editors, fact checkers, you know, everyone from the magazine. It's almost like a rolling dinner party. And we invite everyone to have a kind of shot to, like, and I always tell people, don't suggest an idea that you think I will approve. Suggests an idea that you want to read. Like, that's the point. It's for you to actually express your sensibility, your opinion, your aesthetic. And like the greatest thing for us, I think, is at the end of that meeting, like Susan and I will turn to each other and say, "Who was that?" And that is usually
we pass notes back together, saying, "Who's that person?"
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, we have this like new person that we are learning from. And I think that's one of the things about institutions like this is that, you know, they're not top down. In some ways they are, but there's almost, you know, it has to be a constantly refreshing, you know, spring or it dies.
And to that point, I think I'll just finish this one point. To that point, I think both institutions, we have to be careful that, I mean, sometimes what happens at the New Yorker is we'll hire a young person because they have a really fresh kind of fizzy voice that we feel that we need, you know, we that's the kind of thing we need to replenish. But then something happens that I call New Yorkeritis, when somebody gets there and they feel like, oh, I'm at the New Yorker now. I just have to write really serious stuff about serious people. And we have to shake them out of that and say, no, we want you because you have your own unique voice. And I think Lorne has to deal with that sometimes too. You know, the new writers will just try to write things that seem like SNL sketches rather than weird groundbreaking stuff. I mean, the word I use most often when I'm giving a writer notes on a revision is that I want it to be weirder, you know, just surprising.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, as Martin Amis titled the collection, The War Against Cliché. Like, that's the truth for both magazines and for humor, is you got to make it new. Anyway, let's ask some questions from the audience, okay. And I'm sorry for going on.
No, all the way in the back.
So thank you very much. The first question I had, you finally got around to answering, which was I was wondering what Lorne Michaels' reaction was when he first found out that there was going to be this book, and then you really talked quite a lot about that, very clear about that. But I still have two other questions, one New Yorker question, one Saturday Night Live question. The Saturday Night Live question is, the show was on 11:30 late. Did Lorne Michaels want that, choose that, because he knew there'd be irreverent material and it was going to cater to a certain audience, or was he delegated that time slot because it wasn't sure that it was going to be a hit right off the bat? That's the Saturday Night Live question. The New Yorker question is, David Remnick's been there for a long time, and he's obviously successful because this is a time when print media is really struggling in general, but the New Yorker seems to be doing okay. Nevertheless, he also has time for the radio show, the New Yorker Radio Hour, which kind of blows my mind that he could, because the editor seems like, being the editor would be such an amazing stretch. This other gig, which seems like that's also a lot to take on. I mean, I knew that he was out there more than Mr. Sean because he was on the Charlie Rose show a lot. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, just a different kind of person, but I'm still surprised he can pull it off, those two worlds. And so those are my two questions.
Well, the 11:30 question is very simple. Lorne was pitching his show for years to executives who just kind of glazed over and didn't know what he was talking about and didn't care. You know, they thought he was some kind of crazy pothead. But what happened in 1975 is that Johnny Carson wanted, what NBC used to do at 11:30 was put Carson reruns on, The Tonight Show. And in 1975, Johnny said, I want you to take that off the air because I want to take you to put the rerun on Monday night so I could have another night off. So the network just had this dead air. And they wanted to find something to put on, and they didn't really care what it was. Lorne, you know, they offered him that, and he said, sure. I mean, he realized that if you're on at 11:30, none of the executives are going to be paying attention. He said the time slot was basically like an empty lot on the edge of town. And, you know, NBC was in third place at that point. I mean, this was the lowest, least of their concerns. And, you know, he always said he wanted the show to look like kids had come into the studio and taken over after the grown-ups had gone home. And frankly, that is exactly what it was. But his show would never have flown in prime time. It wouldn't have been able to have George Carlin talking about, you know, making religion jokes and you know, putting up cards saying, you know, send your pot to this address, you know, for testing. And, you know, they wouldn't have been able to do that. So it was one of those accidents that was completely essential to the show even happening. So I'm going to let Daniel field the Remnick question.
You know, I think there's an expression that writers use where they say to, you know, express the incredible, you know, difficulty of writing. They'll say, like, I hate writing, but I love having written. David Remnick loves writing. For him, it's like the morning jog. Like, there is nothing that is more satisfying to him than writing or going on the radio and having a conversation that he has perhaps prepared for 15 minutes, because he's just an at-ease polymath. You know, there are certain people who have that gift. And, you know, I have a stable of about, you know, 13, 14 writers I work with, and, you know, some of the most brilliant people I work with, like, productivity of a certain kind, it's difficult because they're trying to polish every sentence, and until that first paragraph is absolutely a work of, you know, diamond-like, you know, perfection, they cannot move to the next paragraph. And then there are other people, like Rebecca Mead is someone I work with, where there's just like, oh, I have to write this weekend. I'll have it for you on Monday. And like all the things that everyone grouches about. For her, it's a pleasure as much as like going for a swim. And that is David Remnick's superpower, is that like the notion, like whenever we publish our July 4th issue, we have a week off at the magazine, and David went to Israel for his holiday week. You know, he just loves to work. And it's not like in this kind of stakhanovite, like, I like to work because I want you to see how much I'm suffering. He just enjoys it. And, you know, it's a kind of gift. You know, a lot of our writers resent it, I can tell you that, because he makes it look so easy. And certainly, I think the radio show, the one thing I will say about that is that he couldn't have done that when he started 20 years ago as the editor. You develop skills and mastery, and you develop trust in the people you work with over those 20 years. And so, you know, it was about 15 years ago that the radio show really kind of kicked into high gear. And, you know, he disappears like on a Tuesday afternoon and a Thursday morning, And it's almost like it didn't happen. It's like he went to the dentist's office, and then you have a radio show. But so he just has that ability to go from one thing to the next with ease and pleasure. And it is a nice thing to have a boss like that. I remember, you know, I'll just say this one thing, like where I worked at the Times once, someone told me that the thing you do not want in an editor-in-chief, particularly at a weekly, there was someone who used to edit New York Magazine. And apparently, like every Tuesday, she would walk through the halls saying, "What are we going to do?" And you don't want to hear that when you're working on a weekly schedule.
The only thing I would add to that is one of the reasons that David is able to so gracefully flit from task to task is when you do a magazine every week, you know, the thing really works efficiently. It's like a train on a track. Everyone is good at their jobs. It just it becomes a little bit like a self-cleaning oven. And that's what allows him to be that way, I think.
So I have two or two and a half questions. So an SNL question. So Lorne Michaels is now 80 years old. For many of us, when we achieve that venerable age, we're thinking about legacy. So did that come across in how you dealt with him and how he projected himself to you? That's one question. The other question for you both, about Michaels or Remnick, frankly, you both have presented lovely, laudatory portraits of great men, but they're human beings. So tell us something about their warts.
Well, Lorne, the great thing for me is that Lorne's warts, there weren't any creepy skeletons in the closet, you know, which would have created a difficult, you know, would have had to figure out whether to put those in the book. I probably would have. But his warts are highly amusing. And like, for instance, he just loves celebrities. You know, he really is what you'd call an old-fashioned star fucker. You know, he loves his famous friends. He loves to drop their names. I find it kind of charming that he's so unabashed about it. Like, he doesn't, you know, I mean, the day he told me that whenever he saves all of his voicemail messages from Paul McCartney, I actually found that kind of heartwarming. I mean, wouldn't you keep that, right? But, you know, so he's unapologetic about just being like a mogul and living a really rich person's life. You know, I mean, you know, he has a big spread a couple of hours from here in Whiting, as you probably know. And I know that one of the reasons he picked that spot is because the airstrip was, you know, big enough to handle a jet rather than a prop plane. So, and he's unembarrassed about things like that. So anyway.
So I get the enviable job of ratting out my boss. No, the thing that will drive me a little crazy about David Remnick is he is anxious about not just repeating the kind of sleepy 1970s New Yorker kind of formula in which there was a kind of pleasure in saying, "We've just published a 21,000 word article about walnuts. We dare you to read that." And what that means is that he gravitates towards what he calls the big dumb idea. It's a little bit of embarrassment because, you know, if you say, "Hey, should we do a tart, you know, snarky profile of Megyn Kelly?" He'll say, "Yes!" Like before you finish the sentence. But I want the magazine to both be about walnuts and Megyn Kelly. And I don't mean that in a silly way. I mean, you know, to me, the most thrilling articles are things in which you would never have expected to be reading about this. Or there's a structure to that narrative that is, it was a mystery. Where is this story going? And, you know, I love stories about science, and I love stories about, you know, I'm always looking for the, you know, sentence in, you know, an article in the Times. It opens up a new world for me because I've never heard that before, and therefore he hasn't either, and therefore he doesn't have an opinion about it. And so sometimes I feel I have to say 10 times, like, "This is important, this is interesting," and that is my role, I think, is, you know, and your role is, he has a, you know, a sensibility that is sturdy and topical and newsy and brilliant, but we try to make him a little more esoteric, a little bit more willing to try something experimental and new. And when that doesn't happen, I'm pissed.
And the only thing I would add to that is that especially at a time like now when the world is going to hell in a handbasket, And we're covering these important political stories very, very well. I think it is important to always remember that we have to offer readers some alternatives too, that you don't want wall-to-wall misery, because it's too awful.
Okay. Another question? How about this lady in the back?
Thank you. I wondered if in your book, or if not in your book, but just to hear how you would think of the eras of, you know, like the Bill Murray era, or, you know, how Bowen Yang entering the fray changed things, or, yeah, just, it seems to me that if one looked, one could see different eras that sprang up from the newer people coming on.
Well, the show is, you know, Lorne is a big New York Yankees fan and a big hockey fan. He's Canadian. And he thinks a lot and talks a lot in sports metaphors. Will Ferrell told me, you know, he's a lot like a baseball coach. He keeps the highs not too high, the lows not too low. But one of the ways that he, you know, evinces this sports thing is that the show is like a sports franchise. There are always going to be rookies. There are always going to be people cycling off. That's just, you know, like New York City, the show is in a permanent state of being torn down and rebuilt. And I think that you can generalize about certain eras. Some eras, there are a lot of stand-up comics on the show. Some people feel that they don't work as well because stand-up comics are used to just communicating kind of with the audience, and they don't work, you know, listen to each other as well. Like, a lot of people think that the best eras of the show, and I'm thinking of like the one where, you know, Phil Harvey and Phil Hartman and Jan Hooks, like in the late 80s, the ones where you have a lot of improv players, because those people listen and tune into the other performers. So in any case, it's always, always changing. When I was in high school, it was the original Not Ready for Primetime Players, you know, Chevy Chase and Gilda Radner. And I love them. But I have a fondness for two other casts since then, that Phil Hartman, Jan Hooks, Dana Carvey cast I was just talking about. But also the one about, I guess, 12 years ago, Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, Fred Armisen. I think that was the coolest group of people that they ever had. You know, just very cool.
Okay.
Hi, you mentioned the book took 10 years. I was wondering if you could tell us why it took so long, basically, and then how your conception of the book and what it should be evolved over that time.
Well, it took 10 years, I guess, because I have a really demanding day job, and I took very little time off. So I was working on weekends. I was doing the David Remick thing of working at 5 a.m., and it just took that long. I mean, I spent a few years just reporting, and I kept reporting after that. And then I ended up writing a book that was almost twice this long. You know, I've never done it before. So one of my writers, Tad Friend, you know, I think I was doing it first, but Daniel was describing it. I was, because I'm an editor, my editor brain was preventing me from moving forward until every paragraph felt just right. And then Tad Friend said, no, you have to just do the vomit draft. You have to just put everything down and then go back with your editor hat on and fix it. So that took a really long time, you know. And, I mean, I certainly wasn't slacking. I was working really hard. And in terms of the way the conception of the book changed, it was definitely a big moment, probably 4 years in, when I had this idea of doing those days of the week chapters, which radically changed the structure of the book, and I think made it a much, much better book, and also made my understanding of how the show works like much sharper. But I think when I started, again, I was such a novice, it hadn't occurred to me that to do this book properly, it was going to have to also be you know, like an encyclopedia of show business of the last 75 years, an intellectual history of the 20th century. I mean, it really had to cover a lot of ground as comedy became intertwined with politics and, you know, social mores and everything else. So I really bit off a big one.
Let me just say, as you know, a colleague who loves Susan and was aware that she was taking this really big, long swing, the moment when, you know, I was one of the first people who said, can you read this manuscript? And oh, the deep breath I took before I dove in, because I thought, you never know. But what was amazing for me, and I think if you guys read this book, you'll see that in addition to being just full of lore and wisdom and kind of insight about comedy itself, is that you can see that the editor of New Yorker articles is present, like that the awareness of like, I need to be a witty presence myself. I need to like not just puff up Lorne Michaels, I need to both capture what's smart about him and also notice what's irritating about him. And so it tacks in the way of a New Yorker magazine writer. And so there's just a way where you saw all of the wisdom that she'd accrued kind of, you know, shaped in this way, and that takes time.
Okay, we have one last question.
Lorne was a comedy writer, and there were a couple other comedy writers in the 50s and 60s. I wondered if Lorne ever crossed paths with Woody Allen.
There's a great Woody Allen.
One of my favorite sections of the book, my favorite little gold nuggets of reporting, has to do with this. When Lorne was in Canada, before he moved to L.A., he had a writing partner, this kind of goofy guy who was a law student named Hart Pomerantz, and they sold one-liners, they sold jokes to Joan Rivers and to just various kind of Catskills comics, and they got a call from Woody Allen's agent to come down to New York to write some jokes for Woody. Because at this time, his career was really heating up. He had a Broadway show on, Don't Drink the Water. He was making several movies, and he had all these different comedy specials on TV. So they went down, and this is the golden part. Hart Pomerantz was a sort of nerdy guy who had rigged a briefcase, Maxwell Smart style, with a hidden tape recorder in it. And because he was too nervous, he thought he wouldn't remember what they were doing. So they turn up at Woody's townhouse on the east side, both of them terrified because they were huge Woody fans, and Hart presses this button, and there's a 3-hour brainstorming session recorded on tape, which I got to hear. And of course, you know, it's really pretty flat. You know, Woody has a setup. It's okay, there's a lobster in an aquarium in a restaurant, and he's afraid he's going to be eaten next. What's the joke? And so it's like 3 hours of them, you know, talking about it. And what's interesting is that Lorne, you see the seeds of his Lorne-ness in this. Like, he kind of dominates, you know, he's leading the thing, even though he's just this little schmageggy from Toronto. But he also, almost all of his jokes have to do with status. Like he says, one of them is like, well, maybe there's a clam who needs his help, but he won't help him because, you know, he made fun of him once in school. I mean, it's inane, and it shows you just the banality, the hard work of coming up with jokes, you know, that it isn't just this flash of lightning, it's just this grind. And nothing came of that writing session. I mean, Hart showed me the canceled check from Woody for $500 just for that day. But there was one thing. They went back to Toronto with their tails between their legs, and then Lorne had a joke. He came up with a joke that he thought sounded very like Woody, very brainy. And he called him on the phone, and he told it to him. And I'm going to try to tell you the joke as best as I can. It's, there's a guy who becomes obsessed with the idea that somewhere else in the world is like a doppelganger to him, who is thinking exactly the same thoughts as he is at the very same time. And he's obsessed with trying to track this guy down. Finally, he gets this person's phone number, and he calls him, and the line is busy. So he called Woody from Toronto and told him this joke. And Woody said, that's a pretty good joke. You know, I don't think I'm going to use it, but that's a bright joke. And And Lauren said it kept him going, you know, for the next 3 years. If that hadn't happened, he probably would have done what his mother wanted and gone to law school.
Let's thank Susan and Daniel. Thanks again to Working Loose. There are some